right, let's turn the music down and turn our microphones up. I am so excited to start the Aging Well Together show for our loyal listeners. I'm sorry we were off last week. It was my birthday and I was traveling to Colorado to see my daughter. But we are back live with just such a good show today. I am thrilled to have my wonderful colleague and friend here, Dr. Erin Kent. I almost said Erin Content because you make me so content. Here, I'll put her microphone up. And Erin is amazing. She wears so many hats. She's a researcher, professor, associate chair, and collaborator at my alma mater, the Gilling School of Global Public Health, in the Health Policy and Management Department, my old and current stomping grounds a bit. Erin and I work closely together on the North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition, and Erin conducts important research and practice in the caregiving and serious illness space. I am so excited for all we'll learn together. But as always, before we dive into our show, we need to give a shout out to WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carrboro for hosting our weekly Aging Well Together show. You can catch our show every Thursday and often live every once in a while, pre-recorded every Thursday from 2 to 3 on 103.5 FM if you are within 1 mile of our signal strength, or you can stream us live through WCOMFM.org. And I think Erin's husband might be listening to us live. So if Erin's fan club is listening to us live, hello from the Drakeford Library. You can come by and we can wave to you on the other side of the windows. The Aging Well Together show is brought to you by the always helpful and wonderful team at the Orange County Department on Aging. Besides being our fabulous sponsors and expert guests on the show and fun, Erin, you'll find this fascinating. Alicia, you'll always find this fascinating. They'll be here next week to kick off in preparation this show and next week's show. Because November is Family Caregiver Month, we've got our friends at the Orange County Department on Aging. Kendall and Hannah are going to be here to talk about family caregiving and the resources through Orange County Department on Aging. So besides being our wonderful guests, Marilyn posts all of our previous shows on Orange County's website. So if you want to catch up on any of our past shows, and today, Alicia, it's show 91. Wow. We're getting older. We're getting more experience. We're getting more seasoned. I know. I've got big plans for our 100th show. I'll tell you about that. You can find our past shows or a range of wonderful local resources for Orange County if you go to the Orange County Department on Aging's website, which is, and this is where I'll slow down. I'm a little over-caffeinated. It is www.orangecountync.gov/aging, orangecountync.gov/aging. If you have any questions about local resources, you can also go old school and call the Orange County Department on Aging, and their main telephone number is 919-968-2070. I always repeat 919-968-2070. And if you have questions about our shows or want to suggest a topic or a person or an organization, we are deep into scheduling 2026 now. Please feel free to email me at agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. I'm getting new suggestions all the time, and so we're busy scheduling. I love it. Shout out to the community-based band, the Carrboro-based band, the Robert Bradford Quintet. You heard only like 9 seconds of their original music. You'll hear a lot more at the end. Thank you for allowing us to use your music, the Robert Bradford Quintet. and my fabulous co-host, Alicia, who looks ridiculously serious. Aaron hasn't met you before. You're giving off a vibe. Are you okay, my friend?
Everything's good. It's going to be even better because Aaron's here.
Alicia Reed is here. She comes on. She's on our show to add her lovely spirit and positivity. And then she comes on right after us with Afternoon Talk with Alicia. She also gets people moving and motivated as one of the amazing wellness instructors. Everyone but me.
A challenge.
Aaron, ongoing segment, how sedentary.
We're going to work on her.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe her birthday present.
I know. Birthday present, you should have me work out with you, but you can find her at the Orange County Department on Aging or really volunteering with any community organization. She is the quintessential Orange County volunteer.
Don't skip over that birthday thing.
I'm not going. You know what? We're getting into my birthday right now because this is where I talk about me. Okay. I am Heather Altman. I am your host. I have been in aging services in this community for over 25 years. I help older adults and their families connect with resources. I talked to two new clients today. A lot going on. I also am a caregiver for older family members. And as of a few days ago, and at 55, I am focusing on my own changing needs and super invested in how we are all aging well together.
And I left it.
Oh my goodness.
Don't worry, you'll be here.
We can do it next week, but
it's
yes.
It's your birthday month.
You know? It's my birthday month. And Aaron, you haven't heard me. I don't think you were on the meeting. In the meeting the other day on Zoom when I talked about I'm so excited for my Walgreen birthday. Oh. I call it the Walgreen birthday because at 55, you start getting the senior discount at Walgreens.
Nice. And senior coffee, too, at McDonald's.
Well, I have to figure out because certain places like Harris Teeter, it's 60 or 62. Yeah. So which groups do I heard Ross Dress for Less might be 55. So which groups have the 55 plus discounts? Others, it's 60. But I know
AARP has a list.
I started to look into AARP. I was excited to join at 50, but then they actually said it can be any age. So I joined AARP at like 47, 48. They dropped the 50. So anyway, enough about me.
Congratulations on birthday. I left her bag.
Oh.
You have to come back.
I had a great birthday. I was in Colorado. It was wonderful. I got to spend time spoiling my daughter, Sydney, who's in college in Colorado, so I don't get to see her that much. And we went thrifting all day and then went to other stores because she has a new apartment. And so, I got a new purse from Salvation Army. You'll see it. It's so cute. $6.99. So
we upselled, reselled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. We have got to get to Dr. Erin Kent. She is here with us today. We've been talking for so long. You got to come on the radio show. And I finally got her here. Let's talk about some officialness. She is Associate Chair for Research and Associate Professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management, as I already shouted out, my former home, the Gilling School of Global Public Health. She is a member of, I found out all these things about Erin. I stalked you. She's a member of the Limeburg Comprehensive Cancer Center and a Health Services Research Fellow at the Cecil G. Shepps Center, working with the Rural Health Research Program. And then I saw some stuff and then I added some things. Her mission is to develop and implement into practice supportive care interventions for serious illness. She conducts research that informs the development of policies that support caregivers. She develops strategies to promote a more equitable culture of care. She conducts this work in collaboration with many interdisciplinary researchers and clinicians at UNC and beyond. We're going to talk about all of those things. I have seen firsthand her passion for supporting students and her colleagues, and more importantly, all of us who are caregivers. Thank you and welcome, Dr. Erin Kent. Yay! Oh, wait, hold on. Hold on.
Oh. Wow. That's some pretty... pretty special applause. This is such an honor and a joy to be with you, Heather, and to meet you, Alicia, and be in Carrboro at the Drakeford and on the radio.
I know. We're normally, and Aaron and I are on a tremendous amount of Zoom meetings together, so we always have like a computer screen separating us. And then what's super fun is we get together in person, but not in our home area. We get together in Raleigh and we get together in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Somehow it takes other meetings. And now we get together with fun microphones.
At the Drake.
Wow.
At the Drakeford.
This is so hip.
It is so hip. We're so cool. Not that you're on our radio show and our podcast, because we're recording. So we're going to get all into your work. We're going to get all up into your business. But before we do that, give us a little background, because I only hear about this, you know, sometimes over professional and personal cocktails. But remind me and tell everyone, where are you from and how you got into academia and research?
So I am a seventh generation Californian.
Whoa. Did we even exist seven generations?
I know,
ago?
Right? So I grew up and spent my like first 30 years in California. My dad's side of the family actually had a farm in Salinas. My dad didn't continue farming, but however many generations ago, someone came over. Actually, I found out much later, from North Carolina, in a covered wagon.
Wow.
You know, following the whole like
you
gold rush
legit.
Farmland
yeah.
kind of yeah. thing in the 1840s, and we have a journal still in the family with
wow.
all the colorful spellings and just accounts of his journey.
Anyway,
but that's sort of like that's way further back than you
this
I think
is,
intended.
No, no, we love that. This is really interesting.
So I really didn't ever think I would leave California. I mean, it's a
and
lovely.
And you give that California vibe, that kind
northern,
of chill, relaxing.
Southern.
So grew up in Orange County, but then sort of
lived in Orange County.
Oh, nice.
It's so funny, you're
Orange
second
County.
Person. She's the second person that's been here.
And the irony is, this is one of the first shows that I did not say, when you're coming to our website, you have to do orangecountync.gov.
Oh, right.
And I literally was ironic, trying not to be too chatty, but we often say that because if you put in orangecounty.gov, as people do, they end up in Orange County, California, and get the wrong. I should have said it because legit.
No.
Feel free, folks, if you want to understand Orange County, California, where Aaron's from, go on.
Yeah, so I moved out here after all of my schooling. Went to UC Irvine, go Anteaters, zot, zot.
Sure.
And got a degree in social ecology and studied epidemiology and public health there, but moved out to D.C. actually to do a postdoc at NIH in cancer survivorship and cancer prevention and control, and then ended up taking a job as a program director. And that is actually where I started working on caregiving.
When you were in D.C. at NIH?
Several steps to sort of get there, to sort of really kind of understand this whole concept and like world of caregiving. And then I was very hooked.
Interesting.
And after a period of time, I thought, you know, this has really been great having this 30,000-foot perspective on caregiving, on cancer control, but I really think I want to go back to academia, get to work with students, and also maybe leave the Beltway a little bit, maybe get
funny,
down.
You went from one crazy tower to another. Mm-hmm. You went from the Beltway world political tower to the ivory tower.
I like that.
I like finding through lines, but go on.
So moved down here to Chapel Hill in 2017 and then started working at UNC in 2019 and was really excited to be able to join my department, Health Policy Management, your alma mater.
And I guess I should shout out myself, and I'm still there. I have an adjunct appointment, will come up later because every once in a while I can be on Aaron's dissertation committees for her students because I've got a little bit of street cred over at HPM.
A lot of street cred in all sorts of spaces, but including our department. Yeah, so I think that, like with so many people and certainly academics, I think it it takes sort of insatiable curiosity, as a lot of fields
do. Oh, I love that term. We're pausing you. Uh-oh. Let's write that down. Insatiable curiosity. Okay, go on. Sorry. Alicia taught me to take my notes in a notebook so we can...
We refer, and
you see it. This is what both of our shows are about: insatiable curiosity.
Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
No, you're scholars of the radio podcast world. So, you know, and I think a lot of us end up having a really sort of stepped or even circuitous path as we continue to sort of figure out what our scholarship is going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started being very interested in, I think, human behavior and social connection. My mom was a clinical psychologist, and it was always like nothing was off the table. Like in our conversations at home, like we talked about, I don't know, like heart of the matter kind of stuff. And so I was always really interested in those things, but I had never... I, of course, later I look back and I'm like, oh, I witnessed caregiving all the time, but I didn't have...
We didn't have a name for it back then. It was just like, oh, I'm just being a good wife, daughter, son, granddaughter, neighbor, church member. We used different... temple member, in my case. We used different language, and I remember just even naming it a caregiver or thinking about it in a new way.
Absolutely.
Sorry, go on.
No, absolutely. So it sort of led me to, I sort of discovered public health, really, as I was kind of getting my degree, and then also got very interested in cancer, and sort of, you know, how anything I could do to help the quote-unquote fight against cancer, or the war against cancer. Mm-hmm. And I started out being very interested in etiology, like what's causing cancer. And I had a few experiences, including just starting to work with some oncologists, that made me much more interested in what we do with and for people who actually have the diagnosis and those around them than necessarily trying to prevent cancer. And I have a lot of kudos to all my colleagues who are continuing to do that work. I just felt more at home with the sort of the coping after the crisis piece.
I think in terms of bumper stickers or something, those little pithy comments. And I feel like, so you moved from the cure space to the care space.
I love it. Yep. That's exactly how I think about it. And then I'm a real sucker for unsung heroes, I would say, right? The people who get to do all the work but get none of the credit.
Or pay. As we'll get into that.
Or support or training or preparation, all of it. And so it really felt like my call, you know, that whole like ikigai model of like what you're good at, what's calling you, you know, what can contribute to society. I finally sort of found that really as I was getting my postdoc, I would say.
Okay.
And then, so here I am to stay.
And you came here. I'm debating whether I should ask you this question because I know a little bit more about you. You didn't come alone. There's other people in your life.
Yes.
And I didn't ask about this, but there's another world that you know well as well. I'm the military.
Oh,
world.
Yes.
I'm so sorry. I was like,
wow,
because I remember this, but also I've had some discussions at home about what I offer on the radio is what I offer and not other family members' issues or not issues, but their experiences. But you don't just know the political DC world and the academic world. You're connected to military.
I'm glad you brought
that
up.
I think your husband's listening, so don't get mad for me to bring this up, but I want to give some honor and love there.
Oh, that is so kind. My husband is a veteran. He was a physician for the Navy for 13 years. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, when we met, he was in medical school and then did his training for the military. He did his residency, I should say, an internship. And then we were able to move together, which is very difficult to do with a military and academic career. But we got fortunate and worked hard, too, but to kind of align our careers. And shortly after we got to Maryland, we were living in Rockville, Maryland, which is near Walter Reed Military Medical Hospital, as well as NIH.
Mm-hmm.
I had my firstborn daughter, Grace, and when she was one, he deployed to Afghanistan for 8 months. And you know, we had moved across the country, and so we had a wonderful cadre of people that I worked with, but I didn't have any family out there, and so we just sort of made it work as best as possible. At that time, we had, remember Skype, when Skype was
Yes, I remember Skype.
We were able to Skype with Mike, with Daddy, like maybe once every few days. And, you know, I mean, I remember like lugging my, those like incredibly heavy infant basket car seats
out to
my car, which I would try to like go throw the keys in and start it and hope nobody would steal my car.
Yes.
So I could thaw it in the winter. And then like at that time, like I was trying to dress like super professionally and I'd wear like heels, which was so stupid. And I'd like try not to slip on the ice.
I don't know, but I just remember that in pleated skirts and
polyester, right?
Yeah.
And like not try to like I'd have the infant car seat and like my breast pump and my work bag and all my stuff that I'm trying to get into the car without slipping on the ice and like get this poor child to daycare so I could go to work and like, you know, it was wild.
So much you've gone through.
Sorry.
And so
that's just the picture I have. I had to like,
it's wonderful. And I think part of what this show does and what we try to do in other is put the face and the experience behind this research. There's always a bit of, I know that term, me search, you know, like you've gone through your own journey. And so you really can feel for what others have gone through. And Mike, if you're listening, I say not cliche, but seriously, thank you for your service. And I knew that you have been in a number of worlds, and that in it is its own military world, and being a mom and having a deployed husband, and while you were doing your research, I just know that this is all part of your story, and so I didn't want to miss the opportunity to call out the militariness but I actually didn't realize that Mike is Dr. Mike. Good. There's a lot of doctors in your family. Your mom and
all very different kinds.
As my dad calls me, and I won't call you this because we'll just use our own. My dad and I are useless doctors, as we are called in our family, because anyone that cannot give a prescription, my sisters are like, we have a whole bunch of useless Altman doctors. You know, just we can talk about policy and economics, but nobody can write a prescription.
So true.
Okay, so and I always, it's not that I forget, but we do so much in the caregiving space in general. And then you're like, oh, I have a cancer meeting, or I'm part of this cancer collaborative. Mm-hmm. So I forget that your origin story was through the cancer and oncology world. So,
So I guess at NCI, at the National Cancer Institute, where I worked for a number of years, mm-hmm. I had I kind of found a niche in trying to build up research resources for researchers who are mm-hmm. interested in caregivers, because there really wasn't, and there still remains, kind of a dearth of support of funding, really specifically for caregivers, and it's tricky. But some of the other spots in NIH, like the Aging Institute, for example, is a little bit more kind of poised to help caregivers. And I had to make the argument several times, like, we do also need to study cancer caregiving. There are similarities to caregiving with an individual, an older adult, perhaps with Alzheimer's or related mm-hmm. dementias, to someone with cancer, but there are also distinct things that mm-hmm. happen. And so I became really motivated to kind of help the Institute get on board with funding grants specifically in cancer caregiving, or actually developing some surveys and research resources more about cancer caregiving. And I think things have come a long way.
Yes.
But there's always a long way to go, too.
You know, I hadn't thought about that for this show, but I have two new clients that I spoke with today, both adult daughters trying to address the complexity of their moms that have dementia. And so most of the clients that I work, most of the people, there's a few folks that are working in a cancer space. Sometimes that's an added on, but generally when they're, I do see a lot of caregiving support in the brain change, in the dementia space. And I do wonder, I have some theories, but they're not well thought out, so I don't want to say it on the microphone, but it's just also when someone else needs to come in. A lot of folks who have cancer, I don't know, still have their own cognitive agency or right. capacity to identify some of the steps they need in their support, whereas with dementia, it's often the people around them. So there are... We always try to find the similarities when we're doing advocacy work, but there are distinct differences in the type of support, I guess.
We actually, in I think it was 2016, 2017, were able, when I was at NCI, we were able, with the support of the National Cancer Institute and AARP mm-hmm. and the National Institute for Caregiving, put out a smaller report about cancer caregiving in the U.S. that used data from this really big seminal study that happens about every 5 years called Caregiving in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to actually put together a report that looked at just some comparisons between cancer caregivers and people who are caregiving for individuals with other health problems.
Seeing that.
And I think the byline was an episodic and intense experience or caregiving experience mm-hmm. because one of the biggest patterns that we saw was that when you looked at people who were saying that they were a cancer caregiver versus, say, someone who was a caregiver for someone living with dementia, is that they tended to be caregiving for a shorter period of time overall, mm-hmm. But that their number of hours per week, the number of mm-hmm. things that they were doing, medical, clinical, nursing tasks, were generally on average higher. Their emotional distress.
For cancer.
Oh, so again, yes. These are patterns. It doesn't necessarily ring true for any one individual, but that's kind of what we saw. And so that also helped us make the case how there are things that are different.
Because it's shorter, more intense, and more. So unfortunately, my close friend is going through, her young daughter has cancer, and so is going through chemo treatments right now. So yeah, there are these episodic where there's a lot of needs, and it's very clinical. Or for me, when I was caring for my dad and there was a lot of wound care, I mean, it was, I was playing nurse and doctor of like right. a lot of bandaging and stuff like that. Very different than when it's intense and just as intense, but in very different ways than someone for whom you're looking at now a few years of activities of daily living. It's yeah, okay.
Right.
Stop rambling on. But they just came out with the U.S., the Caregiving in the U.S. 2025 report. And we should do a shout out. The North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition, we are doing our symposium on October 28th, 29th, and 30th from 12 to 1:30. It's free. It's online. Folks can listen in. And we are October 30th, Thursday the 30th. That's why I won't be on the show. From 12 to 1:30 is going to be looking at the caregiving in the U.S. 2025.
It's such an incredible resource. It is really wonderful.
Oh. Yeah. All right. I should do a quick shout out. What's our website? www.ncsicoalition.org. Did I just... I should know my own nonprofit that I help to run. Why am I... It's so funny how I very rarely talk about it, but I'm going to look up. But yes, NCSI as in North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition.org.
Join our voices, I think.
Yeah, and then you can get in, and then once you're on the website, the very first thing you see is the Joining Our Voices Symposium. So then I'm thinking about your through line and your why, and I could ask this more appropriately, but I prefer to ask things inappropriately. Let's talk about why research, like you geek out. That's your space, but you know, we'll talk about, I know you have a few hats, and we'll talk about like teaching and associate chair, but the excitement about research, I'm just curious. I don't even know if that was a prepped question. I'm just thinking about you, I know you're really motivated to make a difference. What is it that research allows you to do as opposed to me and Alicia, who have a radio show where we work with folks, but like blah, blah, blah. There's no, you can't PubMed us. Right. You can't find our publications.
Well, I would say the best kind of research, though, at least in this sort of public health, applied health research space, mm-hmm. really is symbiotic with everything that you all are doing, with practice in general, right? So mm-hmm. if what research is at its core is, right, is the pursuit of creating generalizable knowledge. So we can, a lot of times we'll distinguish projects and programs that are doing something to benefit, say, an organization or a group, mm-hmm. Which is all to the good. But the research piece then tries to create generalizable knowledge or evidence is the other word that people use that other people can then apply. So it's like the building blocks we would hope of bettering our society. So that's what I like about research is you're leaving breadcrumbs, but more than breadcrumbs, hopefully, mm-hmm. for others to come after you to be able to build on what you've discovered, what you've tested, what you've, you know, hopefully using rigorous methods, but that they can then take that and build and do better. But it's
like
not
the toolkit, not reinventing the wheel, and also learn from other people's successes and their failures. Like, hey, if you have, we all have limited time, attention, resources, this is what we know. This is what people have found beneficial, and this is what they haven't. So, yeah.
Right. So it's not okay if it just sits on a shelf and nobody ever uses it or reads it. And that does happen to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately, I think public health has led the way of helping us think beyond just the tiny experiment or the tiny study that, you know, that nobody ever reads about, that just collects dust.
Yes. Okay, let's go on a fun tangent about when I was doing my public health program, there was some debate about the word innovation. Okay, good. Yeah. You're rolling your eyes. And I had a colleague who was a program officer at a foundation, and they said, we stopped asking people for innovative programs, because truth matters, not a lot is innovative. A lot of things have been done before. And so it's more like at some point there's a lot has happened. So let's not constantly be, and I don't want to stop. There's constantly innovating to the sense that you're reinventing the wheel, as opposed to there's great things that are sitting on a shelf, like that we know have been effective. Let's get those things out, whether it's scaling it. But this whole issue of someone thinking, oh, this is a brand new thing. Now with AI, there are some brand new things, I guess, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of it, yeah, you see my point there. It's like a lot of great things have happened, and then the funding gets lost, or the people have changed over. And so
true. Yeah, it really, the breaks in the pipeline. I mean, there's all this, there's research.
We're just ranting.
There's implementation research is a whole field, right, of research that often talks about how it can take, on average, something like 17 years for a discovery to
that.
Be implemented into mm-hmm. practice. And of course, there's a range on that. But the idea that, we can get too precious about certain things, and yet we still want to be as, I think, rigorous and careful and thoughtful about our
methods. You do. I don't. Which is why... Which is why I'm very loosely tied. I don't have the patience for it. And you and I were in a meeting once, and it was really funny. Because you're like, well, we need some more data for this. I'm like, don't we have enough? Aren't we done yet? And you're like, no, we need to get a little bit more data to make this. We want it to be rigorous enough that others will listen. And it's like, if you talk to two people, it's like, well, it's much more powerful to talk to 20 people mm-hmm. or whatever. But I don't think I have the rigor, which is why... Someone once was giving me some feedback, and they're like, well, you know, as a public health researcher, we think you should do that. I'm like, oh my gosh, are you classifying me as a public health researcher? I was not classifying myself. So I think there is a lot, and I love that's why I love working with you, because it's helping to sort of build what has happened and also to keep creating new, I don't know, like, I see you with a bullhorn, like, here's really important stuff, people listen.
Yeah, and I think there's a balancing act, and there's tension in all of this, right? Like, when do we have enough to act? And there's, you know, this whole idea of, like, are we doing more harm by not acting, or are we doing harm by acting too quickly? And that's not always easy to figure out. I mean, I think in supportive care, I mean, we do have to be thinking about using our resources wisely, because when we put money into something, we're taking it from someplace else.
Yes, it's finite.
But supporting people through the things, for example, that caregivers need, which is training, preparation, respite, support, mm-hmm. feels like a really good investment.
And let's dive into that, because that's actually something that I wanted to give more time and depth to, especially since we are going into, I know we just started October, but we are going into Family Caregiver Month in November, and for you and I and Alicia, I mean, caregiving is an everyday thing in our lives and in our work. But when you rattled that off really quickly. I got timing, preparation, respite, support. In your caregiving research, and I know you do a lot of what we call qualitative research, where you talk to people and you listen to people, what is it that, like, diving even deeper, because the support, or you can go into each of those four things, what are you hearing that people really need, caregivers really need?
They what they often articulate needing is a variety of things, depending on where they are in their caregiving journey. So oftentimes in the beginning, it's information, and it's I've heard people say that as a checklist. Like, I wish you could just give me a checklist at the right time so I knew all of these things I needed to do. Because there's a lot of hindsight, because by the time you actually talk to people, they're sort of usually past a crisis. Mm-hmm. But as much information as possible about what's to come and about things that they need to do. And although oftentimes caregivers in the moment can't articulate this either, this idea of sharing the care and of help and a helpful network comes up a lot. So seasoned caregivers who are really able to reflect on their experiences will often sort of say, by sort of way of giving advice, like, please to others, like, ask for help.
Yes.
And the problem is, a lot of times,
it's so hard to ask and
a lot of us have a really struggle with asking for help, right?
Our culture has caused that, you know, to live separately and to not be involved and keep to yourself.
Right, be individualistic and just figure it out on your own. But the problem
is, there's only a few things.
Millions of people trying to figure it out on their own, and it's not working.
Mm-mm. And people, like, I think about the classic, you know, the food chains. Like, people are like, okay, I know I'm going through a lot, so, and it's amazing, people, you know, who'll make dinner for this family or casseroles, and that's amazing. And I think people have learned, like, that's a way to help. Give food, receive food. And then, but then it gets more interesting. And you talked about, you know, having a younger child. So then you start getting into, well, what's important for that person when it starts to get into childcare or letting someone else do your laundry or, you know, transportation to appointments or sit with my family member while I go. I have a few friends that would do that.
And one of the interventions that, that I have, that we're continuing to adapt and test and, you know, try to make better is actually at its heart about that. It's trying to get people to understand that help or support can come in many forms and help coach them around how to actually ask for help and set boundaries and really kind of navigate problems. And one of the things I find and I talk about is, to the extent that a caregiver, a primary caregiver, can deputize other people to help them in different areas. Because frankly, the person that you're going to want to maybe have sit with you during an appointment might not necessarily have to be the same person who helps pick up meds at a pharmacy. Or even, you know, brings over a casserole or helps you with your GoFundMe page or helps you connect with clinical trials that might be of interest to you. There can
people
be different
have
people
different,
in different roles.
Different gifts. And I mean, I think for me, the writing and the thinking that I have done, and I've got to share some other stuff with you, is based on my own anecdotes, not, I mean, informed by research, but I haven't done rigorous. But yeah, I mean, really thinking through, even when my own dad was sick, and he's fine with me talking about it. Like, my sisters and I was very comfortable in a clinical space. My other sister was too. We were really, really comfortable just being the bedside in the ICU, all that. My other sister, but I had no patience for keeping other people in the loop.
Right.
The relatives, the friends, my father was working. He's still working. Like, what's going on? It's like, I had no patience for that. Mm-hmm. So we quickly created titles. I was VP of Clinical Services, made my sister Vice President of Communications, because I just had, and she's not as comfortable in like the direct clinical. They're like, she's anti-Band-Aids. Like, she just always has been uncomfortable with that. And so she would be like, she's like, I've got it. She was in charge of all. And then my other sister, she was comfortable with clinical, and we made her like Vice President of IT. She was really good about, like, let's get Dad's iPad working and things like that. But it is interesting seeing people's
Deputized.
Yeah, I love the term deputized.
And I love hearing your situation, Heather, because I think that's sort of like the ideal scenario mm-hmm. when you have not only collaborative roles, but that you have kind of lanes to sort of
you didn't like,
have lanes.
I would do that. Right.
And I do, I'm not supposed to use the word counselor because I'm not a counselor. Yeah, I'm a consultant. When I consult or coach or advise other family members, and I like doing family Zooms where I talk to them. And what are your skills and interests? But also, what are your boundaries? Mm-hmm. What is really uncomfortable?
Who wants to give you a bath? Who you don't want to go in the bathroom with you? Yeah. You know, those things are important.
It's very important. What are they? What's their comfort level? And also, my big thing with myself and what I see a lot of caregivers is not being second guessed. Mm. That's like the worst thing. And I have I don't do it in a researchy way because I'm having different ways to discuss it, some with expletives and things like that. But the last thing someone who's in the deep depths of caregiving needs is for someone to go, why are you doing that? Or what about this? Or, well, couldn't you do this? And it's not helpful. If it was helpful, they would ask and they would. But this constantly second guessing people who are in the trenches is not helpful. Yeah. So I have different ways of, and telling, you know, because mine was during the pandemic, telling my sisters we were separated and my close friends, just saying I'm doing okay. Like, I don't need advice. I don't need anything. I mean, you can send me some food. That's nice. But just being like, you're doing great or you're amazing or it's okay or a safe space to vent without trying to tell you something else. But the, okay. That's my thing. But so other things that you are finding when you talk to caregivers, we'll bring it back to.
You know, I think that caregivers often hit roadblocks in all kinds of ways. You know, whether it's they don't have access to a particular type of service that could be extremely beneficial simply because their loved one doesn't qualify for something. That can be really frustrating or sort of, you know, like finding out that they only need this one help with this one thing, but in order to get that help with that one thing, they have to sort of sign up and pay for a service that's far more expensive or unwieldy. So there's those kinds of things come up a lot.
There's no reference guide, and they go into it not knowing they're going to be in it for any period of time.
Absolutely. But people, I'm seeing more and more, and it's coming. Well, you do see some from ARP and others. I have a colleague that's just coming out with their own. It's becoming like an industry now where people are writing their own checkbooks or guidelines or helpful things. And a lot of them are really helpful. So now it's sorting through, well, what's the best thing? But it becomes so overwhelming. When I talk to caregivers, I will often say, what's the thing that's heaviest on you right now?
That's a great phrasing.
Because there's so many things that can be discussed, but it could be like your transportation. Or I was talking this morning about some of the legal documents that are needed. And we'll also talk about housing. But it was like, because otherwise we could just talk about everything and we spent a lot of time and attention and I can clearly talk a lot and exhaust people. But we haven't gotten into what are we prioritizing? Because clearly that checklist is long.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right.
And depending on the age we were talking about, because like I'm around 85, 90, that's a whole different need because of everything that has changed in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And their wants and needs are just, they're unclear because they don't understand a lot of the things going on.
That's a good, you know, caregiving, and I know Aaron and I in our work, we try to do caregiving across the lifespan. And so we brought together our, you know, medical moms, as they're called, the pediatric, the really complex caregiving for children, different than adults with disabilities, different than older adults, as you were saying before, cancer versus
caregivers.
Oh,
right?
That's a huge issue. We talked about it a little bit on a show recently, youth caregivers. So what are your, you gather all this information. Mm-hmm. We could go even deeper about what you hear from caregivers. And then what? Yeah. How do you, and I know you hang out in D.C., but I know you hang out in conferences. Mm-hmm. What do we do? Now your mind is filled with all these brilliant insights and papers.
Where are we applying them?
I mean, I think we push on different places where we might have traction, right? So, I probably am more in the Venn diagram of like researcher and advocate because I do a lot of this work with organizations like yours, like the North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition and the North Carolina Caregiving Collaborative.
Look, I made a Venn diagram. Look, I drew it.
And so I definitely do participate in that piece of it because I think the need is there and inertia is strong. Like we just keep doing the same old thing.
I know.
But I do think that there are opportunities sort of at the federal space and at the and at the state and local. And frankly, that's where the action is. You know, when you need a resource, you need it at the local level.
That's right.
So I think connecting the work that we do to some of these efforts where there may be funding and maybe decision making about how things get funded is important. And then I think a lot of public awareness. I mean, so you've probably talked here on the show, Heather and Alicia, about the National Family Caregiving Strategy.
A little bit. I haven't spoken about it in those terms because it's funny. We had Nathan Boucher on recently. He's a researcher. So we talk more about the supports. But so tell folks what that means.
So in 2018, a piece of legislation called the RAISE Act, which I believe stands for, let's see if I can just recognize, assist, include, support, empower. I might have gotten one of those wrong, but
I didn't even realize RAISE stood for something. And I've been like, this RAISE Act stuff. I didn't. Oh, my gosh. Go on.
So that legislation was signed into law in 2018, I believe. And what it did was it created the impetus for a national family caregiving strategy. So you'll hear about the national strategy,
That's that language.
And then there's five goals associated with the strategy. And then what they did was there was a report to Congress in 2022 that outlined, I think, 350 federal actions and 150 actions that states could either already were participating in or could. And the thing that I like about the strategy is the first goal is simply to raise awareness.
Yes.
A lot of people don't even, I mean, they may have heard the term, but they not necessarily identify as a caregiver. But the more people can understand that caregiving is everywhere. It's ubiquitous, right? Mm-hmm. And that most of us will either be or need a caregiver in our lifetime. I think that's really powerful because then people start to, when they're going through it, they start to experience the fact that they may have some sort of unmet need, whether it's simply finding a service, finding information about their loved one's health problem, learning more about where other caregivers might be so they can have some peer support and validation, just simple problem solving things. Like it's a really big deal to, if you have an older adult who needs help with activities of daily living, to start helping with the basics like, you know, feeding, bathing, dressing. That's a really big life step to go through that as an adult. And so knowing where those resources are and feeling sort of getting that emotional support that you might need, as well as financial support and resources. Caregiving can take people out of the workforce. It can be incredibly costly. So there's all of these different pieces that the national strategy is trying to put forth. And all of that can benefit from evidence. So that's as a researcher,
and
what we can do.
This national strategy, this is a congressionally approved, I mean, this is a big, this existing. Was a federal blessed work. So I highlight that because it's gotten more attention and it continues to be a bipartisan issue. So while everything is political when it comes to, I think, funding and allocating, but there's been a lot of focus and it doesn't have a party line to it, which is nice.
Right.
But yeah, so okay. So then it's funny. I know that the first goal is about raising awareness and the fifth goal
is about expanding
data and evidence. And so, I think we are well poised here in November and you and I have been talking about meetings to get our folks together. One of the things, and I know because we have just a little bit of time left with the caregiving, you talked about your cancer work and caregiving in general. I did want to, you have a specific focus on rural, or you have had your SHEP Center and the Rural Health Center. And I just, because so much of North Carolina is a rural community, I didn't know if I'd hate for the show to end and it to be like, oh, wait, we didn't talk about the rural issues, if you would like to.
Yeah, A lot of the rural comes from the fact of where we are.
Because I was talking about, I was thinking, my link was all the resources. And here in Orange County, we are so resource.
We are.
There's never enough, but we have a lot of resources and abilities. But in other communities around North Carolina, not as fortunate.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, we are, I think we're the second, we have the second largest rural population in the U.S. in our state.
What?
I did not know that.
Yeah. North Carolina has the second largest rural.
Because 3/4 of our counties are considered rural. So that's a big, so when we're sort of living in these urban or suburban spaces, we forget. But we're a very rural state.
And that I know. I drive around a lot of this state during workshops. It's beautiful. I love it.
It is beautiful. And I think, you know, there are, again, there's an increasing amount of awareness and increasing number of resources, even in our resource constrained environment, to help connect more people. I mean, broadband and broadband access is increasing that can help. Digital connectivity is a huge issue.
It's a huge issue, and it is amazing. And in some of our caregiving policy priorities, ensuring there are still areas, there's areas of Orange County when you drive through, all of a sudden you can't connect. Nothing. And with so much online resources or even telehealth, I can't believe it when I'm driving through and I'm like, oh my gosh. Nothing. So yeah, the broadband issue is part of our public health and serious illness priorities because of it. Okay, sorry,
absolutely.
Go on.
Absolutely. I think too, I mean, and then workforce. So understanding how we can better train and prepare the direct care workforce pipeline to not, to have more people who are engaging in that really sacred work and have them be more available to families when they need respite is hugely important. Important rural health issue.
I was thinking about this last night as I was watching yet another discussion about how AI is going to replace so much of the workforce. And while there are some robotic innovations that can do direct care, and there is more with kind of remote viewing with cameras, it is still one of the growth areas where there's lots of jobs. Unfortunately, they don't pay very well, but there will be lots of jobs at the end of the day. Like, people would ask me, what do you need? I'm like, as a caregiver, I need 2 more hands. Yeah. That's right. I need I need another person with me to help me. And so that whole issue around workforce will continue to grow even in this age of AI, but unfortunately doesn't have the recognition or the compensation. Go on. Sorry. I'm ranting in between your comments.
I was going to say, too, the other thing that I do want people who are listening to know about, and I'm sure you've talked about it on this show quite a bit, is our multi-sector plan for aging.
You know, we've talked about it a little bit, the multi-sector plan for aging. It's so talk about it, but we highlight the programs within it.
Yes. So, but people... if they're interested in learning more, it's a plan called All Ages, All Stages. And it is, you know, we're in sort of the early implementation stages. It's supposed to be 2025 to 2035. But one of the 4 main areas is supporting older adults and their families. And there are specific recommendations in there for supporting family caregivers moving forward. So there's a big emphasis on that statewide and connecting our various area agencies on aging and other community supports to help do that so that we're making sure that we're attending to individuals in all areas, including and with a strong focus on rural. One of the actual recommendations, so it's kind of a line in the plan, is about continuing to support some caregiver-specific programs like Project Care, Caregiver Alternatives to Running on Empty, which can provide some degree of training, counseling, even respite for some caregivers. But then also the North Carolina Caregiver Portal, or nccaregivers.org, I believe, which is a free portal. It's anybody who identifies as a caregiver in North Carolina can register, and then you can get access to all kinds of information.
I did, and I get emails
all the time,
every day. Hey, we're having this support group, we're having this webinar, and it's really fascinating. And I'm like, wow.
And you can certainly ignore it, but if it speaks to you as a caregiver, right? You have these
different times. It can be anonymous. You can join.
There's chat boards on there. There's also direct, you know, phone numbers and contact for people who are in the caregiver support program to reach out to if you need help.
You know, it is making me think, and Alicia, it's like you're like, of course you must have talked about this. I'm like, actually, we've had 91 shows and we haven't really talked about it. It is an interesting thing. We'll need to make a list. Like, what is it that people should know that they often don't know? You'll have to come back for another show and whether or another few shows to talk about. Here's what often we hoped, wish people knew that they don't know. And it could be about resources. Let's think about that.
Yeah,
or initiatives that.
There's just so many people that I know that don't know.
Yeah. And
you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, there is something to be said for people. People are on their own individual journey, and they are part of this broader sort of cultural experience, right, of becoming a caregiver. Right. It's different, certainly different than, say, becoming a parent. The one of the ways I think it's similar is it is this life event, and it is this role that can be incredibly impactful. And so sometimes knowing about what other people have gone through before you
stumble onto it.
Yeah, I'm still
knowing.
I'm wondering, do they have?
Empowering.
I keep wondering. They must have a what to expect when you're expecting caregiver edition.
I don't know.
I've been wondering about it for years. They must. And I mean, we, as the research shows, what we have more people 65 and older now than we ever have in history. And so, you know, I think it's also because of what I do. Every cocktail party, every event, especially in my 55-year age world, which is a lot of our children are older in college. And so it's all about what's happening with our parents now.
Right.
Parents, people are living a lot longer, which means that scrambled sandwich generation
is the norm. It's just, and it really
everyone.
Is the norm, right?
Yeah. I have folks that are clients in their 70s and they're thinking about themselves, but they're caring for their parents in their 90s. Mm-hmm. And it's complicated. All right. So here we do. I told you the time would fly by. We have a minute left. So your last question before you come on to the show for next time. And we got to a lot of things, but we didn't get to something. What gives you hope? What makes you excited when you think about the world of your world now of and we just only touched on your caregiving world. We didn't talk about your faculty work and your administrative work, but in your caregiving world and in the research world, what gives you hope and what gives you a smile?
I mean, the students who are excited about studying serious illness, aging, caregiving, long-term care. That gives me hope to see all, and they have, you know, the next generation always has better ideas, more energy, more creativity, and the fact that we've got a lot of, you know, generally speaking, younger adults who are interested in studying those things and making a big difference. That gives me hope.
Oh, I love that. And that, and I get to experience a lot of your students, our students together. Oh, that gave me the smiles.
Yeah.
Well, always being with Dr. Erin Kent gives me the smiles because she's just wonderful. And she will definitely come back now that she knows where we are. I'm already thinking of like two other shows for you to come back on. Thank you so much, Dr. Erin Kent. Thank you so much, Alicia Reed, and everyone. Stay tuned in a few minutes for Afternoon Talk with Alicia. Thank you, WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carrboro, for letting us use this beautiful studio. Thank you to Orange County Department on Aging for sponsoring us. And as always, listeners, thank you for engaging with us. And we will actually be on next week. So take care.